I'm Dennis Chamberlain, and this is Sea Space Colonies, the podcast from the frontiers about the frontiers. Broadcasting from Aquatica, Mars Base 1, and from Port Isengard, on the edge of the far side of the moon. Revolution, wrapped in four transonic booms. Claudia and I have grown to love and live the expedition life. It's evidenced around our house where a scuba tank, a double-hosed antique regulator, or a backpack still stuffed with accoutrements of a recent mission, well, they're never out of place. Yesterday's micro-expedition was relatively short, spanning a mere 2.5 hours total, and traveling across the Indian River and Merritt Island to the shoreline of the Banana River, just south of the Kennedy Space Center. Over the years, we discovered this sweet spot to watch significant space launches. We arrive and claim our private beach and set up our chairs and spend a couple of hours thoroughly enjoying the natural ambiance of the subtropical eastern shorelines. Yesterday morning was quite unusual for our rock-strewn river shoreline. The cool November wind, following a steady northerly fetch, sweeping across the miles-wide river from near the Space Center to our chairs. Also unexpected, we watched fog build before our eyes as the cool breeze swept across the Atlantic and collided with the moist morning air on the shore. Along with the fog came the worry that it would somehow obscure our view of the launch of the SpaceX Falcon Heavy, which we were there to witness. Claudia and I have witnessed hundreds of launches together since our honeymoon days 30 years ago. Yet her launch experiences far exceed mine, as she grew up in Cocoa, Florida, and watched the Gemini and the Apollo launches from her front yard. And these days, we rarely miss viewing any launches from our yard, just a few miles from her childhood home. But this launch was different. This was a launch that demanded that we experience it much closer. As I wrote in Departing Earth Forever, when we stood on this very riverside beach in 6 February 2018, we witnessed the first extraordinary Falcon Heavy launch. And when the pair of side boosters returned and landed right before our eyes, I knew at that moment that not only had history been made, but all other launch technologies on the planet had just been rendered totally and even embarrassingly obsolete. Many think of Falcon Heavy's inventor, Elon Musk, as a precocious frat guy. But you know, in reality, this precocious frat guy is an authentic millennial genius, a rare individual that humanity is only blessed with once every 1,000 years or so. And Elon wears an invincible, permanent smile that lets some of us know that he's always up to something. Something unexpected, something outrageous, something epically fun. Well, the Falcon Heavy rocket is a prime example of that. Unexpected, outrageous, and epically fun. And when Elon announced the Falcon Heavy, it scared the living daylights out of the establishment's high priest, securely ensconced inside DC's many ivory towers. You can check out that incredible story in our book, Departing Earth Forever, Book 1, in a chapter titled Radically Divergent, available on Amazon.com. Musk designed the Falcon 9 to be partially reusable, landing the very first stage after every mission and reusing it over and over again, sometimes as much as 15 flights per booster. NASA claimed they had already tried that, unambiguously implying that their solid rocket boosters actually cost the taxpayer more to refurbish and to reuse than it would have cost to manufacture them new for every mission. Well, only government could possibly be that wasteful, so no surprises there. Thus, NASA warned Musk that his plan would be more expensive than just letting his boosters fall into the ocean as scrap after each mission, just like governments have always done. Elon's response was, "Hold my beer." And by SpaceX's process, Musk not only made profits, he radically reduced launch costs for everyone and thereby cornered the entire launch market. In contrast, today, Old school and entrenched NASA intends to fly their first SLS mission sometime this month, throwing all of their epically expensive hardware into the ocean after each mission at $4.1 billion per launch. Meanwhile, SpaceX can launch 45 Falcon Heavy missions capable of launching payloads of up to 52% of SLS's advertised capacity for the price of one NASA SLS launch. Pound for pound to orbit, a customer can purchase a Falcon Heavy launch capability for 30 times less per unit mass and have most of their hardware left to launch many more missions. Now recall that the Falcon Heavy is constructed from three garden variety Falcon 9s strapped together side by side. So when Elon first proposed it, even his engineers warned him that while the single Falcon 9 launch vehicle is stable, strapping three of them together could very well induce vibrations in ascent that would tear the craft apart in flight. And here I'll paraphrase Elon's response, quote, "I'll consider the first flight a success if it doesn't take out the launch tower before it blows up," end quote. Well, it didn't blow. It flew brilliantly and forever changed space exploration history. The launch we just witnessed on 1 November was purchased by the Department of Defense for a classified military satellite. And why didn't they purchase it from NASA or a private contractor? Well, because NASA only has the SLS Heavy Launch System, and although it isn't even actually available yet, no one would ever waste that kind of money, even another part of the government, period. And what about using another private contractor? Well, the only rocket currently operational that could handle that mass would cost DOD just shy of twice the charge of the Falcon Heavy launch. So DOD did the only rational thing they could do. They bought their ride from Elon. SpaceX's bargain basement $90 million price for a ride on a Falcon Heavy uses three pre-flown rockets and recovers all three first stages. Expending or throwing away all three stages is never an alternative for SpaceX. But expending the central stage to give the payload an extra boost to high orbit is acceptable. So with all the money DOD saved by not using another contractor, they were easily able to purchase three new boosters and ditch the core stage to reach their desired orbit. They also get the bonus of retaining the side boosters solely for future DOD classified flights. No final price was announced by either party because the mission was classified, but it is presumed that the United States Space Force got quite a deal. So yesterday from our riverside viewpoint, we watched the launch pad on the shoreline across from us appear and disappear between the gossamer dance of the oddly out of place fog line for more than an hour. On the broadcast streaming to my iPhone, which is 40 seconds slower than real time, the massive Falcon Heavy was enshrouded for most of the last half hour in relatively dense fog at the former Apollo Launch Complex 39A. But we could see that just to the south, down the beach, the SpaceX landing pads, well, they were mostly clear. And from where we were observing, everything was also clear. This was extraordinarily good news for us because we didn't come to see the launch at all. We came to see, hear, and feel the pair of boosters land on the beach. Okay, so the launch was also super cool. And what geek could ever deny that? Knowing that the video feed I was watching was typically up to a full minute out of sync with reality, after the T-minus 1 minute mark, I lowered my phone and watched the horizon. The heavy launch vehicle suddenly raced out of the low fog bank, leaping towards space, trailing three Falcon 9 columns of fire streaming out of its 27 engines, all the way to the 27 Merlin Main Engines Cutoff, or MECO. We watched and waited for the sound of three Falcon 9s strapped together. Well, launch sound is fickle and entirely dependent on many complicated weather conditions. You never know what sound effects to expect from any launch, but to our delight, this one was loud and long, but not three Falcon 9s loud. Unfortunately, the fog had obviously absorbed some of the acoustic effects. As veterans of this process, we knew where and when to look for each phase of the launch process. Although the destination for the satellite was classified, I could see that the blazing rocket had turned sharply south toward a near equatorial orbit, which in turn determined our ultimate viewing calculus to observe the pair of first stage boosters execute all three of their return burns. We were looking for the three-engine boostback burn in orbital space at about 120 miles altitude. We were also looking for the three-engine entry burn to reduce the stage's hypersonic speed as it drops back into the atmosphere that prevents heat damage to the vehicle. And finally, at about 4.8 miles in altitude, the single-engine landing burn begins, reducing the vehicle speed to zero at the moment of touchdown. We were unable to see the boostback burn due to the thin layer of high clouds and impinging sunlight. In fact, we can only see that boostback burn for launches on very clear nights. But we were not disappointed at all with the re-entry burns just south of the zenith. Although the first stages are not visible to the naked eye at 33 miles in altitude, during their 28-second burns, the unique weather conditions created momentary contrails for both boosters after the engine firing, was something we'd never seen before. We immediately adjusted our gaze toward the horizon on the Atlantic beach and the landing pads at the Cape Canaveral Space Force Station. And less than a minute later, a single Merlin engine on each booster began its landing burn. At this point, the stages are clearly visible, riding the columns of fire down to the beach. The first set of boosters that we saw land in 2018 landed together side by side in formation, just blowing our minds. Well, this pair had a 3-second separation, and the first settled down to a landing 31 seconds later. Wow, seriously, what could be more exciting? Wait for it. The icing on this awesome cake is still on the way. Just appreciate that the rocket we just watched and land traveled from 120 miles in orbital space, reversed its direction, fell to Earth at hypersonic speeds, and made a precision landing on the pad in just over 5 minutes. From nearly 25 times the speed of sound to landing, the vehicle has reduced its velocity in the atmosphere from Mach 25 to zero, breaking the sound barrier multiple times during this process. And then the end result of all that sudden energy loss hit us, literally. A pair of nearly instantaneous double sonic booms reached us about 3 seconds apart. The pair of double booms are penetrating, and we literally feel them. It's both startling and thrilling, a fitting end to the flight. The idea and the genius of all of us becoming a multiplanetary species, together unfolding before our eyes and even inundating our physical forms. Indeed, it is a revolution wrapped in 4 transonic booms. So, what's the difference between humanity colonizing space or colonizing the oceans? We're so glad you asked that question. And the answer is found in spades at quantumadditions.com. Semper explorandum, always exploring.